Sephora stores are everywhere you are. So just pop in when you need a brown lip to match your 90s playlist, a confidence boost before your interview, or a last-minute gift for mom's birthday. There's always a Sephora near you. Just pop in. Use our store locator to find your local Sephora or Sephora at Kohl's.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Everybody, welcome to Profoundly Pointless. My name is Nick Vinzant. Coming up in this episode, disasters and bathrooms.
So this is where, you know, a disaster happens. You jump on a plane, you try to get to that community as the disaster is happening, and you're interviewing people, you're making observations about how the response is unfolding. You know, as you start to look back at what happened last year, you can see all of these different, what I call forks in the road, of where one decision or another could have been made. And nearly at every turn, the United States, particularly the federal government, made the wrong turn, right? That said, we still have a very long way to go before we're talking about any kind of like apocalyptic scenario. And in that sense, we do have time to act. We do have time to make changes.
I want to thank you so much for joining us. If you get a chance, like, download, subscribe, share. We really appreciate it. It really helps us out. So our first guest is an expert and has fascinating insight into things that we see constantly on the news. We are bombarded with disasters of all kinds, right? COVID, climate change, super volcanoes, meteorites, asteroids, hurricanes, tornadoes, floods, plagues, zombies, everything. There seems to be a new disaster happening somewhere every single day. But how do we actually study, learn from, and maybe even prevent some of these disasters from happening? Our first guest is Dr. Samantha Montano. She's a disasterologist who studies exactly that. So what exactly is a disaster? Like, what has to happen for it to qualify as a disaster?
Depends on who you ask, but generally when we are talking about disasters, we're talking about a situation where something has happened, a community becomes overwhelmed, and they are in need of help to come from the outside to help with things like search and rescue, opening shelters, addressing medical needs. So when you have a tornado that goes through a town and takes out half of the town, that would be a disaster, right? They're going to need that help to come from the outside, versus a tornado that just goes through an empty field and, doesn't really cause any damage. That wouldn't be considered a disaster.
How do you study one?
Well, that's a good question. So when we're thinking about disasters, there's kind of the before, during, and after. So, we can study disasters all the time, right? We can study the level of risk that a community has before a disaster happens, and we can go afterwards during the recovery and do interviews and collect data. But we also, and this is kind of maybe the like cooler part of disaster research, we can go during the actual disaster and do what we call quick response research. So this is where, you know, a disaster happens, you jump on a plane, you try to get to that community as the disaster is happening, and you're interviewing people, you're making observations about how the response is unfolding.
Are we having more disasters than we have in the past?
In some ways, yes. We definitely have newer types of hazards that we need to contend with. So kind of the interconnectedness of our systems, the complexities of things like our electric grid have increased our vulnerabilities, have increased our risk in some ways as compared to, you know, 200 years ago. At the same time, we do see that generally there's been a decline in the number of deaths related to disasters in the past several decades. A lot of that is tied to advances in warning systems, advances in forecasting. So, you know, there are in some ways we're better off than we were. And in other ways, we are seeing an increase in risk because of, you know, those interconnected systems, like I mentioned, but also kind of where we develop in, you know, high risk floodplains, for example. And then, of course, climate change as well.
Can we prevent them, or do we just respond to them better?
No, we absolutely can prevent disasters or at least significantly minimize the damage that they cause. So within emergency management, we do something called mitigation. Sometimes it's called hazard mitigation. If you do a lot of climate work, this would fall under the heading of climate adaptation. But through mitigation, we can do things to try to prevent disasters from happening. So we can, you know, strengthen our building codes. We can rethink our land use policies. We can address issues of social inequality. We can get at some of these more kind of root causes of disasters and try to make changes to, you know, like I said, at least minimize the damage that these types of events are causing.
How did you get into studying this?
So I got my start in disasters post-Katrina in New Orleans. I was in high school when Katrina happened, and I went down to the city to rebuild or to, you know, help with the rebuilding for a week. And I was just absolutely stunned by what I saw. I grew up in New England, and we just never had a disaster that size. And so I had nothing to really compare it to. And I was just horrified by the extent of the damage. And more than that, the extent of the needs in the community. It was pretty soon after Katrina, but it was already very obvious that the recovery was not going to be this, you know, equitable process, that some communities were getting more government resources as compared to others. And so I decided to move to New Orleans, and I lived there for several years working on the recovery with various nonprofits that were, you know, doing kind of everything in the city to help with the recovery. And then while I was living there, the BP oil disaster happened along the coast. And so I kind of diverted my attention down to that response and eventually that recovery as well. And as I saw those events unfold, and again, saw that inequality in how needs were addressed, I was interested in learning more about disasters, you know, understanding the history of why we approach emergency management the way we do.
When you look at some of the disasters, is it more that everything gets wiped out at once, right? Like the power goes out, the cell service goes out, the water goes out, that all happens at once? Or is it a domino effect?
Well, it really depends on the situation. I think, you know, the winter storm that has just gone across Texas recently, I think is one kind of example of kind of a bit more of a domino effect, where you have one system that goes down and then you have issues with water, right? And that kind of is more of what we would call like cascading. But other times, you know, again, depending on what that hazard is, you know, with like a tsunami or something, right? That's all pretty much going down at the same time. So it kind of just depends on the situation. One thing that, again, this comes back to these interconnected systems, but one thing that is important is to think about, you know, when we're thinking about how to prevent these disasters from happening, you know, it's not, you know, are we going to prevent this winter storm from happening? It's what can we do to make sure the lights are staying on? What can we do to make sure people's pipes aren't freezing, right? What, you know, there's different questions that can kind of be asked that can lead us to making those preventative changes early on to try and lessen the impacts.
I'm probably going to ask this question horribly. I hope you kind of can interpret what I mean by it. But is there a limit in terms of our preparedness, right? Like, let's take an example of a dam breaking, and we should build the dam for a 100-year flood or a 1,000-year flood, but is it worth our time to build it to withstand a nuclear disaster? Like, where do we kind of over prepare? How do we balance that besides, like, okay, we've built this thing and it's perfectly safe, but we've also used all the money in the United States to do it?
Sure. Yeah. So the question you're getting at here is related to our risk perception and really related to what we prioritize. I don't think that there is one answer to that question. I think it's something that each kind of community needs to talk about and decide on their own what level of risk they are willing to live with. I agree with you. I think that, you know, we don't need to build every single levee to withstand a nuclear attack or something like that. But I think we do need to look at, you know, what is the risk of this community, right? If you're talking about the New Orleans levee system, you know, I think there's an argument to be made that, yeah, we probably do need to build those levees for a Category 5 storm. There, the likelihood of that happening is great enough that the investment that it would take to make those levees more secure, especially given that this is protecting an entire city, is something to me that is worth that cost.
What are your kind of perceptions of COVID so far?
Sure. Yeah. Well, so first of all, let me say that, you know, COVID is what we would call a catastrophe, not a disaster. So you asked me earlier how we define disaster. And, you know, we're talking about a community becoming overwhelmed. In the case of COVID, we have a situation where, you know, it's not just one city that is overwhelmed and needing help. It's the entire country and, in fact, many countries around the world. And so, and this is happening over an extended period of time, right, over more than a year. And so that makes COVID unique in and of itself. Another example of a catastrophe in U.S. history would be Hurricane Maria and then also Hurricane Katrina and the levee failure. So catastrophes are kind of these more rare events, and they're kind of bigger than what we would consider, you know, kind of a quote unquote normal disaster like a tornado in the Midwest. So that kind of creates a layer of complexity in and of itself in terms of how we respond. From an emergency management perspective, emergency management agencies have been involved in the response, you know, going back to a year ago. Generally, public health has a kind of outsized role in the response to a situation like this, but emergency management is kind of the supportive part of the response.
If you were to kind of fast forward or back up or whatever the correct terminology would be, we look at this years from now, did we screw it up?
Oh, yes, absolutely. So
yeah, we kind of did, didn't we? Yeah.
Like a lot. Yeah. So again, from an emergency management perspective, there are kind of all, you know, as you start to look back at what happened last year, you can see all of these different, what I call forks in the road of where one decision or another could have been made. And nearly at every turn, the United States, particularly the federal government, made the wrong turn, right? They were not listening to public health officials who were, you know, raising the alarms about this back in January. We see that they, you know, were not being always very transparent about the lack of testing or the challenges relating to testing going back to those initial months. There was a lot of downplaying, and even as the president said, you know, our former president said, not wanting to quote unquote cause a panic among the public. And so that information wasn't always told to the public in a direct and consistent and accurate way, which, of course, then in turn limited what individuals could do to prepare themselves. It limited what communities could do to ready themselves and how they understood what was coming. So again, as you go back kind of every decision made in the past year, you can see where a lot of wrong decisions were made.
In terms of like how we screwed it up, one being like, you did, but it wasn't really that bad, right? Like you missed the shot, but it kind of went into the basket and fell out. 10, like, man, you really screwed up. where do you think we would be in that regard?
Well, I always say that things could always be worse. So I'll have to go with like an 8 or a 9.
That bad? Damn.
Yeah. You know, this is one of those things where, you know, it's difficult to find a disaster expert, find a public health expert who did not have a pandemic on their radar as a huge risk that we have, right? When you go and look at the threat assessment, the most recent threat assessment that FEMA did in 2009, you can see that they have a pandemic scenario written in there as one of the major threats to the country. And the way it's written is almost exactly what happened, right? This was an incredibly known threat. This was not some surprise. This was not something that could not have been predicted. This was something that we saw coming, you know, miles and miles away. And because of that, past administrations had done a fair amount to prepare the country for the response to a pandemic. President Bush in the end of 2005 talked a lot about the need to prepare the country for a pandemic. He helped ushered in major changes within the federal government, dedicated additional resources to pandemic response efforts. Again, you see the Obama administration kind of doing something similar following the response to Ebola, of really, you know, wanting to make sure that the U.S. was prepared for something like this. So this is not, again, something that was a surprise. There were systems that were in place. There were plans that were in place. There was expertise that was in place. And, you know, that's not to say we were 100% prepared. Of course not, right? There are, you know, was always more that could have been done early, you know, going back many decades. But there was a system in place for this. And unfortunately, the Trump administration did not follow those systems. They kind of brushed aside decades of research, decades of efforts that had been done to prepare us for a situation like this. So, yeah, in terms of the screw-ups, definitely up around an 8 or a 9.
Is there a quick example that you would say, like, this country did it right?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can look at New Zealand is kind of the country that everybody holds up as the standout example of a country who, you know, took this seriously from the beginning. They implemented measures that, though they were strict, fell in line with public health recommendations in terms of, you know, shutting things down, doing testing, monitoring kind of who was coming in and out of the country. And, you know, you can see, you know, people from New Zealand are posting photos out in crowds the past year where, you know, we have not been able to do that, right? So, you know, obviously there are major differences between, you know, New Zealand and the U.S. in terms of geography and size and all of that. But still, I think that, you know, you can draw some parallels and some pretty major differences there. And you can imagine how things could have gone much differently in the United States.
Does the way that we handled COVID-19 and recent disasters, does that give you more faith or less faith for how we're going to handle climate change?
I don't know that it really changes my thoughts on climate change. I think that, you know, in the same way many political leaders do not take climate change seriously, I think we've seen many political leaders not take the pandemic seriously, very often the same ones. And you can see the repercussions of that, right? I mean, there are over 500,000 people dead in the United States. That is an incredible and unacceptable death toll, given the access to resources that this country has, given the access to knowledge that this country has. And I think that, you know, there is an obvious parallel here to climate change. There is a known risk. We have a really good understanding of what climate change is doing to us now and what it will continue to do into the future. And we have the resources to deal with it. We have the knowledge of how to deal with it. But political leaders won't act. And so here we are.
I'm going to jump ahead a little bit. I'll give you one of our listener submitted questions really quick, because I think it ties right into this. And the listener submitted question is simply this: climate change, are we fucked?
Look, we don't need to be.
It kind of sounds like a little bit of a yeah. Yeah, we kind of
a little bit, maybe. So, look, I think that it's hard to say, right? There are some communities that, quite frankly, are, yes. There are already communities across the country and around the world that are on a daily basis dealing with the consequences of climate change. You know, sea levels are rising to the point that their roads and their infrastructure are flooded on, you know, a regular basis. You have, you know, places that are, you know, communities across the West that have burned down in these wildfires, which in part have been linked to climate change. And so, yeah, for some people, climate change has already screwed them over, right? That said, we still have a very long way to go before we're talking about any kind of like apocalyptic scenario. And in that sense, we do have time to act. We do have time to make changes. And, you know, this isn't just in terms of carbon emissions, but also in terms of what we do to adapt, right? You know, we are obviously locked into a certain amount of sea level rise in many places, but there are things that we can do. We can lift homes up. We can do buyouts so people are, you know, compensated for their losses. You know, we can build different kinds of flood infrastructure to try and protect communities longer. So in that sense, no, we're not fucked. There is a lot that we can still do.
Okay, you know, I love my 1 to 10 kind of things. But if COVID was a 1, on a scale of 1 to 10, if COVID was a 1, what do you think that climate change would be?
In terms of what could happen or in terms of our response to it?
Let's say what could happen. Like, brace me for what we're getting into.
It depends on our climate policy. As of now, I'd say we're headed towards, like, I don't know, 7.
That's pretty bad.
Yeah. It's not great.
Where would you, okay, on that scale, where would you put the meteorite or the meteor or the asteroid or whatever the correct description is that hit the dinosaurs?
I mean, that would probably be a 10, right?
Okay.
So
we're not that screwed.
No.
But we're still pretty screwed.
Not as of now. Not as of now.
We should probably do something about this here climate change, I guess.
Yeah, it would be a good idea.
Are you ready for some harder/listener-submitted questions? Yeah. What is the worst type of disaster? Like, in terms of the type of it. Like, this is always going to be bad. This happens. Oh, man, that's going to be bad. And let's leave climate change out because I feel like that dominates everything.
Probably some kind of like a super volcano eruption would be like the worst of the worst.
Oh, great. That's right. That's just a couple of hundred miles away from where I live. No big deal.
Sure. I mean, look, any kind of situation where there is a risk to food supply and water supply in the long term, and that risk is, you know, global, especially, then that's the worst of the worst, right? That gets at our ability to even live.
There's not like a lot of those though, right?
No, it's not something I lose sleep over, so you should not either.
Okay. Wait, is there, okay, so there's the disaster level, the catastrophe level. Is there something above that?
Yeah, I mean, I would categorize it as like a mass extinction event.
Oh, how do you not be depressed all the time?
Well, I don't worry about mass extinction events because if that happens, I don't intend to survive it, so I don't need to deal with it.
That's a good philosophy, right? Like, smoke them if you got them. Like, man, I'm done.
You know, if you want to spend your time building a survival bunker, that's fine, but I'm not dealing with all of that.
Is that worth anything, right? Like, should people really be doing that kind of stuff?
I mean, I think if somebody wants to do that, they can. I don't know that it's the best use of resources for them personally, but if that's what they're into, then go for it.
I had some buddies that would, not some buddies, one guy that was like, I'm getting my survival bunker to protect myself. It's like, what? It's not just going to be your neighbors that come for you. It's going to be like millions of people, and there's nothing you can do when all of California decides to invade your hometown. Yeah. Like, your survival bunker ain't helping you, buddy.
Yeah. No, I think that, you know, there's a really important distinction to be made between these like hardcore survival bunkers and, you know, a realistic level of preparedness of like having extra food and water in your house. But yeah, in terms of preparedness, also, I'll point out, it's not just what you do as an individual. Our preparedness is very much tied to community preparedness and what we do as a community to prepare the resources we have. There's kind of a little bit of a myth about disasters as being this really like individualistic endeavor where we're all just on our own, but that actually is not what happens during a disaster. People come together, right? You're reliant on your neighbors, your community, your family, your friends. The response to disasters is actually this really like social experience.
Most overrated disaster type of disaster. Like, ooh, people are always worried about this, but it's really not that bad compared to other disasters.
Overrated. That's hard. Well, I don't know. It really depends on the situation. I feel like I'll offend somebody.
That's kind of like a...
I'll say that slower onset hazards tend to, I think, kind of be more manageable in some ways. So again, at the risk of offending a lot of people in the Midwest, I'll say something like a slow duration river flood is something where it can cause extensive damage, right? But you have time to evacuate people, right? There isn't that same loss of life usually as compared to something like a tsunami where you have very little warning. So I think in like some ways, those slower onset disasters are easier to manage.
I used to be a reporter working in Kansas, and I grew up in Kansas, and I would, right? Like, we're not making light of anything. I want to make that clear, and I don't think that you are either, but it is, you're right, right? Like, people there, when I would cover those stories, is like, well, look, we lost our stuff, but we got out alive. It's not the end of the world, right? It's not a place where people really shouldn't live.
I know a lot of people kind of answer this by saying along the coast and, you know, in places that flood regularly. And yeah, I get it. I also grew up along the ocean, so I also get not wanting to leave. And I think there's also a lot of communities that are able to live along the water without, in like a more sustainable way. But I think you can look at, some of the islands, like along the East Coast, even in the Gulf, where, you know, if people haven't already moved, the writing's on the wall for that.
I live in Seattle, and people are always like, you should probably watch out, because if Rainier goes, you're basically a dead man. So, oh, good. Yeah. I like that one.
You know, the thing is that every place has risk, right? And it's just, what is that risk? Is that, you know, is the earthquake going to happen while you're living there? You know, it's hard to say. So, there's always some level of risk, no matter where you live.
Is there a specific type of disaster or a looming disaster that you would say like, oh, people stop talking about that. It's not happening.
Well, I don't want to contradict myself, but I would say Yellowstone. Look, one day, sure, but probably not in our lifetimes. Again, not something I lose sleep over.
Okay, these are the really fun ones or challenging ones. Best/worst disaster movie.
Oh, God. There are so many bad disaster movies. It's hard to pick one. I generally don't like disaster movies, so I think they're all bad. I will say, like, San Andreas with The Rock is not terrible. I just watched Greenland that came out recently. That one was okay. Again, not terrible.
Is there one that jumps out in your mind and be like, ooh, if that happened, that's kind of what that would be like?
they all have, that's a bad example too. No, they're all pretty inaccurate.
is there anyone that is closest, right? Like best of the worst, so to speak.
I think the movie, have you seen the movie Crawl?
No.
okay, there's this movie Crawl, and it's about a hurricane that goes through Florida, and it's mostly about people getting eaten by alligators, but
that is the most accurate disaster movie.
There are elements of that movie that are pretty accurate. Like the main character, she like goes back despite evacuation warnings to check on her family member. Like she's calling other family members. They're, you know, doing mass evacuation. So in that sense, I think the movie is like pretty accurate. But yeah, I mean, they're all pretty far off base.
I know you have a book coming up, Disasterology. Is there something about it that, you know, when you went and collected these stories and did the research, is there something that really jumps out at you about it?
Yeah. So I wrote this book based on my experiences of going around to all of these different disasters around the country, either working and volunteering in them or researching them. And really what I'm doing in this book is trying to show that the way we do emergency management, the way we prepare for disasters, the way we mitigate them, the way we respond to them, and the way we recover from them is not as good as it could be. We could be doing so much more. We could be, you know, saving more lives. We could be minimizing our damage. We could be getting people back to a place of feeling that they are recovered much more quickly and more justly than we currently do. And so really the book is to try to kind of show people that fuller picture of disasters more than just that response to them. And also to put that in this context of climate change, right? Like some of these communities that I go to in the book, like along the coast of Louisiana, Ile de Jean Charles, you know, you have communities that have already begun to move in part because of climate change. And I think we have a tendency to think about climate change as being this thing of the future. But really, it's something that people are experiencing and having to deal with already.
Do these places that get hit with disasters, do they come back? Like, I know they come back, but do they really come back?
Yeah. So this is, again, another kind of complex question, but generally, yes. So in the United States, at least, communities that experience disasters, you know, they tend to rebuild. It's actually somewhat rare for like a whole community to pick up and move. Most of the time they're rebuilding there. And yeah, people do, I think, kind of generally reach a place where they feel like, you know, they're back on stable ground. They have a house, they have a job, they feel like they can kind of move forward in their life. Certainly that isn't true for everyone. You know, some people deal with the mental health impacts of living through a disaster the rest of their lives. There are, you know, definitely differences in who is able to recover and how quickly they're able to get those resources to recover. And certainly when communities do recover, they don't always look the same as they did before the disaster. You know, New Orleans is a much different city in some ways today than it was 15 years ago. But yeah, I mean, generally we do rebuild.
I just kind of had this one pop in. Are you more surprised by our fragility or our resilience?
I think I'm more surprised by our fragility. I think that, you know, again, going back to this point that we generally know what our risks are. You know, even something like the situation in Texas, you can look at the state of Texas's emergency management plans and see winter storms that knock out all the power written there, right? You know, these aren't surprises. And so it's, I don't know if it's surprising, but it's frustrating that we aren't making these policy decisions that could minimize our risk, right? If we know that there is this huge vulnerability with the Texas grid, why is that not being acted on, right? And a lot of that is tied into political decisions, tied into, you know, profit-based decision-making. But yeah, we don't need to face as much risk as we do. That's a choice that some people are making.
I want to thank Dr. Montano so much for joining us. If you want to connect with her, we have linked to her on our social media accounts. We're Profoundly Pointless on Twitter and Instagram, and we have also included her information in the episode description.
Okay. Now let's go ahead and bring in John Shaw.
All right, so we don't usually do this, but I think that something that happened in our last episode was so interesting that we kind of have to. Our guest that was on was a fetish session wrestler who says that she once had a client request that she run over his penis with her car. If you wanted that, how would you go about doing that logistically? Not saying that you do want it, not saying that you're that person who requested it, but if that was what you wanted, like logistically, how would you go about it?
I will say, I guess logistically, if I'm answering the question, I would think that you have to find maybe some elevated sidewalk or a curb. Most men can't lay on their side and have it go to the ground, so to speak.
No. Huh.
And for all you listeners out there that are men, if you say you do, you're a liar. So I would say probably a curb or like maybe some elevated sidewalk.
I think that's the only way to do it. Because if you laid like flat on your back, then she would be running over the rest of you, which would, I assume, cause some massive physical damage. And you couldn't have her like go up a ramp because then that would put too much pressure on one wheel. Right? Now, okay. If you were wanted to do this, would you have a car of choice or would any car work for you?
I mean, if I was into this kind of thing, I would probably want something a little like middle of the road, right? Like not a Miata, but not like a Chevy Tahoe. So.
No, you wouldn't want like a Cadillac Escalade.
This is just incredibly uncomfortable.
You've never thought about having your penis run over by a car.
I can honestly say no, I never have, ever, actually. Maybe a bike tire.
But do you ever have a reoccurring thought, though, of this horrible thing happening to you? Like something that you're afraid of, really afraid of happening to you?
Yeah, but it'd be honest with you, it's nothing to do with anybody else. Like, I'm worried one day that my heart is just gonna stop running.
Yeah, dude, it's probably like, gonna happen.
I'm not really that worried at all about that or think about it or anything like that. I don't really have those thoughts.
I've always been really worried about being in an ATV accident.
I mean, when's the last time you were in an ATV?
Never even been on one. But I've always been really worried about being involved in an ATV accident.
Okay. I mean, sure, I guess. That's just an awkward thing for me to be like, oh, okay, that's fine, because you've never been on one. So why do you have a fear?
I'm just worried about it. I'm just worried about it happening to me.
All right.
I wouldn't get on one. I've never been on one, but I'm really worried about it happening. Like, I'll have dreams that I'm in an ATV accident, even though I've never even been on an ATV.
That would be me saying I'm afraid of a plane falling out of the sky.
I don't know if you've been watching the news, but I think that shit happened recently.
No, everything's
out of the sky.
Everything's fine now. Pandemic's over. Everything's good.
All right. 2021 off to a good start. Okay. Are you ready for your thing? You got your stuff?
Yeah. I am locked and loaded, and I wish we had like a gun sound on here because that's how I feel right now. Like,
we used to have one and you didn't like it.
Well, there's a lot of things
it was John's Fast Five. I don't remember how it went. Pew, 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 pew. Yeah, we did have a John's Fast Five. My son was on it and you didn't like it because my son was on it. So basically you don't like my son.
That's not true at all. I can tell you this. I like the rest of your family a lot more than I like you.
That's legit. I wouldn't have any argument with that. I'm the least. That's a pretty easy thing. I'm probably the least likable member of my family. Where do you feel like you fit in on that category?
Yeah, I mean, of course. I mean, my wife and my two little girls. I mean, I'm like that uncle that nobody likes that just sits in the corner at parties.
Okay,
that no one talks to.
If you extended it though on to the broader extended family, like Thanksgiving style family. Like, where do you think you rank in the list of likable members of your family? The whole family, like everybody who's going to Thanksgiving dinner. Are you in the top third, middle third, or bottom third?
I mean, I should be in the top third, but I'm probably in the bottom third if you ask most of my family.
Okay.
In my opinion, I'm top third, but my family, I'm probably bottom third for whatever reason.
So I'm probably in the top third if you asked my family, but I don't feel like I deserve to be any higher than bottom middle tier of likability in my family.
Is that because you're one of the shortest?
Actually, I'm one of the tallest.
Well, there went that joke. I can't make fun of your family.
Yeah, you can't insult Pop. You can't insult Granddaddy Van Zandt. Oh, you're bringing up my dead mom again. What a dick.
I never have and I never would.
You just did. You brought up my family. Just because my mom died. That's because my mom died this year. Go ahead and make a joke.
I'm sorry about that. Let's just, for those of you that don't.
I like that we do these on video now and I get to see your awkward squirm.
I'm here if you need anything, brother.
Okay, but when you say that to somebody, do you actually, all right, not good friends, somebody you kind of know, like, would you actually be there? Like, hey, I need you to pick me up from the airport. And it's just a coworker.
Yeah, I'm that guy. I would be there for them, sure.
Okay, you're a better man than I.
You telling me that, like, if there was somebody that you didn't kind of, well, you kind of knew, and they were like, hey, I just need a quick favor, you wouldn't help them out? I think you would help them out.
I would have to know in my mind that they didn't have any other options. If I knew that they didn't have any other options, then I would go do it. But if I also thought, like, you could call Steve, then I wouldn't do it. But if I thought, like, okay, I'm the only one who can do this, I'm going to go help this person out, then yeah. But otherwise, no.
You're a good guy. We'll just leave it at that. You're not as much of an asshole as you appear on this podcast. All right, let's give some shout-outs, shall we? All right, these are shout-out time. We're going to start on Instagram here. Rachel Rivers, appreciate you. Caleb Brewer, Alex Moat, Lorenzo Good, Matthew Bricker, appreciate you checking us out. Luke Johnson, Jen Doust, Chloe, with her handle is Just a Girl from East Whittier. Not really sure where that is, but shout out to East Whittier. Bill Blood and Bo Bro Bob. Probably the best name I've seen in quite a while. So I'm just going to take another drink of my Sam Adams Rebel IPA here. Not that they're
a sponsor. Look at you, beer snob, going all the way out and trying the crazy stuff like Sam Adams. What are you going to try next? Bud Light?
Oh, boy. All right. Let's see here. Some things for you to reminisce and think about here. Do you sleep better when it's warm or cold?
Cold. Cold 100%.
My wife is the same thing. I don't know if I believe that. I sleep to, like, where I'll start to sweat, and I like it. Like, I like it warm. I'm not a cold sleeper at all.
You like waking up all sweaty.
Not that I like it, but it's just, it's not the worst thing in the world to me. No.
Do you wash your sheets after you wake up all sweaty?
We usually wash them once a week. I mean, there's a lot of things that happen in the show bed.
Oh, God. That's disgusting to me that you sleep in your own sweat. That's gross, right?
I know, and it makes no sense. But it's one of those smells that it's just great to me. Like, you roll over and, like, you just, you know, you smell your pillowcase and it just
smells. You're a freak of nature.
Smells like.
That's John's wife coming in, making fun of him. What?
That's fine.
That's fine. Oh, are you sad now?
No, I mean,
don't yell at me on the podcast.
Mom, don't bother me while I'm cleaning my room.
Mom, don't bother me. Door's locked for a reason.
I think 96% of people will say they love it better or sleep better when it's cold, but I'm not one of those people.
I don't know. What do you mean the smell of your pillowcase? You like to smell your own bodily waste in your pillowcase? Like, you're all sweaty, just dripping, and you love the smell of that?
It's not like you wake up in a puddle of your own sweat. I don't know how to explain it. It's like you sweat a little bit overnight. You wake up, you're kind of hot, and you roll over, and the pillowcase is kind of cool. But it smells like you because, you know, you've been sweating on it.
So you want to wake? So basically, you want to sleep smelling you all night is what you're telling me. You miss your own smell.
This just getting screwed up left and right.
You're saying it. I'm not saying it.
No, I know, but saying it isn't conveying how I'm actually like how I mean it. So
no, dude, I get it. You like to sweat and then smell your own sweat. That's cool.
We're just gonna move on. Food Network or HGTV? Which one?
Oh, HGTV. I don't know how people can watch Food Network all day and not just be hungry.
I mean, but you get plenty of ideas. So that's why I watch it, so I can cook, get plenty of ideas.
I watch HGTV because I want to see other people's houses and then evaluate if I'm better or worse than they are. But I feel no obligation to then go out and like, I'm going to redo my deck. But if I watch some stuff on TV, then I'm going to go try to make it, and then I'm going to be 600 pounds.
Well, I mean, listen, I'm halfway there. So, well, no, I'm like,
that's kind of crazy when you put it that way. <I'm> halfway to 300 pounds.
And my other question is, what's more telling to you that a person has? Small hands or like small ears, like a small face?
Okay, let's make sure we clarify something here. When you talk about small hands, are you trying to read into anything else? Or are you specifically only evaluating the hands in and of themselves, right? Because a guy with small hands, people will make a joke.
Yeah, and I think I know where you're going, maybe. I'm just talking about any man or person, doesn't necessarily be a man, with just abnormally little hands. Like, you walk by that person and you're like, wow, their hands are not like proportionate to their body.
I haven't really noticed that many people with small hands. I don't really notice that, but I don't notice small ears either. I always notice the way people walk.
Okay. I would say that I probably notice physical features more than like a walking or a talking, like, you know, at first, usually.
Yeah, I don't notice physical features very much at all. I notice much more the person's general demeanor, like just how they kind of move, how they carry themselves, if they have confidence, if they don't. I notice that before I notice any physical features. And that's not to say that I'm like not judging them, because we're all judging people. Like, I'm judgmental as anybody else, but I just don't notice the physical feature first.
Well, I feel like I need to say this now because I've been judging you this entire video podcast or whatever.
Yeah.
And your hair looks fantastic again. So well done.
The hair looks great. Okay. Are you ready for our top five?
I am. Let's.
So this is John's idea. And normally when John has an idea, I have to shoot it down. But this time, it was good. It's a good idea. I liked it a lot. I have to delicately like, oh, I don't know about that one, John. Let's try something else.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I do. So this is top five things that are in your bathroom. Now we're going top five things in terms of most important things that you have in your bathroom, right?
Yeah. Like items, not the toilet or the tub.
Oh, okay. You know. Well, now I got it. What would you say is more important though? The toilet or the shower?
Whew.
Yeah.
That's
tough.
I mean, I feel like I can just go outside with a hose if I had to. A toilet is, like, toilet's pretty clutch.
Yeah, it probably is the toilet, right?
Yeah, it has to be, I think.
Because you couldn't, I mean, I keep wanting to say, no, you know what? I keep wanting to say that it might be the shower is more important than the toilet. But I keep going back to the toilet. Because you could always, even if you didn't want to like go outside to hose yourself off, you could just like turn on the sink and give yourself a sponge bath. So you could get by without the shower.
Yeah, and I think logistically, not having a toilet, then what are you going to do? You're going to build an outhouse, which is going to stink like all hell? Or are you going
to
just poop
in a bucket? Well, I don't think you'll mind it. It's the guy who likes to sleep in his own sweat. I would imagine that you would just hang out in the outhouse all day.
For the two people that are listening to this that agree with me on that, they understand totally what I'm saying, and they're reveling in the fact that I'm standing up for all of us who like that.
What's going to be the name of your support group?
Oh, man. I don't know. Don't hate us because we like to smell our own sweat.
love your own smell.
Yeah. I mean, listen, might be the next thing.
Okay. What's your number five?
All right. So once again, this is just accessories. But my number five is, it's pretty simple. It's just toothpaste.
I feel like, okay, do you have toothbrush in there?
I do. And it's the only thing that I separated because I feel like it's that important.
I kind of feel, I understand what you're saying, right? You can, the toothbrush is more important than the toothpaste. But I do feel like they go together. I think you kind of go together, right? So let's move toothpaste up to wherever your toothbrush is. What's your new number five? You can throw in an honorable mention or bump something up.
No, so then I'll just throw something off my honorable mention. Just a like a bath towel.
Ooh. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, that seems like it should be a lot more important, but then when you think about it, like you could just air dry. It's not that yeah. big of a deal, especially if you're a guy.
Right. Yeah, okay. Yep. Bath towel is my number five. What's your number five?
Nail clippers.
Ooh, that's a good one. I don't have those anywhere on my list because we don't keep the nail clippers in the bathroom at my house.
Where do you keep them?
So we have two pairs, one for the little kids and then one for us, and we kind of keep them in the same little jar in our living room, like with some other little accessories.
Okay. You don't keep them with your 18 different kinds of tongs that you have for various different meats, produce, breads, and grains? For people who are new to this, John has literally like 15 different pairs of kitchen tongs, each one with its own speciality that he purchases for $20 a piece.
I honestly think it's three, but sure, you can say 15. That's fine.
Okay. It's still ridiculous. You need one pair of tongs and that's it.
All right. Well, whatever you say there, Bob Vila.
That's a compliment. I'd take that as a compliment. Okay. What's your number four then?
RIP Bob Vila.
Is he dead?
I don't honestly know. I'm going to look that up real fast because I might have.
I feel
just...
like Bob Vila being dead would be one of those celebrities that you would know if he was dead or not.
Oh, no, he is not dead. He is 74 years old. So.
Oh, he's got a long life ahead of him.
Yeah, he's not even anywhere close to being.
I mean, not a good life, but a long. He's got like time left. It's not good time, but he's got time left.
Yeah, he has some time left. All right, my number four is shampoo.
God, that's my number four, too. Are you a conditioner man?
No, not at all. But
you
I mean,
don't
you
use
can
conditioner.
I have shampoo that is, you know, shampoo and conditioner. But like, I wouldn't buy conditioner separate.
My wife does. I don't know if it makes a difference, but it makes you feel like it makes a difference. Like I only use conditioner on Monday, Thursday, and Saturday, which is the same. The reason that I say that is because those are the same days that I shave. That's why I know that.
How often are you? Do you shower? Are you a shower every day?
Oh, I shower three times a day. Straight up, 100%. 3 to 4 times a day. When I lived in Arizona, it was probably 4, maybe even 5. So
why do you shower so many times?
Okay, it sounds absolutely ridiculous until you kind of understand the circumstances. And the circumstance is that I was born without a sense of smell. So I have no idea if I stink or not. And it is pretty normal for people without a sense of smell to shower more often. Like if I have a, like, let's say I just do laundry and there's a piece of clothing that's fallen kind of near the laundry where it could be clean or could be dirty, I'm going to wash that again automatically.
Okay. Well, I mean, when you say it like that, then I can't make fun of you because it makes complete sense.
It kind of makes sense. Like it's excessive. But you're also like, oh, I kind of get that. How many times a day you shower?
One usually, and it depends if it's in the morning or at night. So
it depends. Like, when do you like to smell yourself more, in the morning or in the night?
I will tell you this, that I think there's been more times when I've at night where I've been like, oh shit, I need to shower. I smell like a pig walking around a farm right now.
I think that's an insult to pigs. We don't actually know what they smell like. What's your number three?
Q-tips.
Do you put them in your ears or do you use them for anything else?
No.
I don't know I don't know what else you would be using them for. I don't know what's going on at the Scholl household.
No, just usually in my ears.
How often do you do that? How often do you Q-tip?
Usually every other day.
Wow. That's way too much, man. You're damaging your ears.
That's what my wife says, but it feels great too. So like, fuck it. I'll spend 30 seconds, you know?
It does feel great. It feels fantastic.
It feels awesome.
Okay. Of things that ranks up with things you can do to yourself that feel as good as solo pleasure cruise and cleaning out your own ears.
Jesus Christ.
Is cleaning out your own ears the only thing that ranks close to that?
Probably on a regular basis. I mean, like if you don't brush your teeth for a day or so and you know, you're going at it, I mean, that can feel pretty damn good too.
Okay.
But yeah. I just think on a regular basis, yeah, probably the Q-tip.
I can't think of anything else that you do to yourself that feels as good as those two things.
No, not, I mean, not at all. pleasure cruise.
Interesting. Yeah, that's weird when you think about it. What number are we on?
We're on my number two, which is
my number three. I just realized we're on my number three.
Yeah, we're on your number three.
Look, I'm going to go off kilter. I'm going to go with lotion.
Just going to have a drink of my beer.
You got a problem with, you got a problem with lotion. I'm not talking about that.
I'm just trying to really formulate a question and ask you why is
I got dry skin. I got dry skin, huh? I got it from my mom, who you made fun of earlier. Rest in peace, Mom.
Oh, boy. See, what Nick's doing right now, everybody, is he's caught because he doesn't want to admit that he's, you know.
Did I like lotion?
Spent a lot of time pleasure cruising, as he says.
Look, I don't do that in the bathroom.
All right. My number two,
I do it on the front porch.
Oh, boy. Well, that would explain some things. My number two is the toothbrush / toothpaste.
Okay, I agree with that. I think we're probably going to have the same number one, but I agree with toothbrush, toothpaste, with toothbrush being the more important of those. You can't do it with water if you had to.
Yeah, and for sure, 100%. Or a water pick. I don't know if you've ever done a water pick, but those are pretty gnarly too.
I have not, but I have a Sonicare. Do you know what a Sonicare is?
I do. I actually have a electric toothbrush now, but it's not a Sonicare.
I'm not asking if you have it. Yeah, so then you don't, right?
Can you just stop yelling at me?
A Sonicare is so much different than an electric toothbrush. It's superior in every way.
I mean, okay, pitch the Sonicare toothbrush to me in one sentence.
Once you try a Sonicare, you will wonder what you've been doing with your life.
Wow.
This is a life-changing event. It was a life-changing toothbrushing event. That's how I feel about a Sonicare.
All right. Well, fair enough.
Okay. What's your number one?
I mean, it's pretty easy. It's toilet paper.
Not soap?
No, not soap. What's your number one? Soap?
My number one is soap. I don't see how you get...
You don't even have toilet paper on the list?
No, I don't, because I can always just jump in the shower if I need to. I also kind of forgot about toilet paper, which should have been higher on, it should be on a top five. I agree that that's an oversight, but I don't think it's above soap. I don't.
I think nothing beats good toilet paper in the bathroom. That's, you know, I even have a bidet, and I still sometimes prefer.
Here we go.
Prefer good toilet paper, man.
How do you not wash your sheets and have a bidet?
I wash my sheets every week. I don't know how many times you're supposed to do that. But the bidet is just awesome. Don't hate on a bidet till you have a bidet.
I'm not hating on the bidet. I just don't understand, right? It's like somebody who has a really expensive car and then buys cheap tires.
I guess if you want to go to that extreme, then yes. But
okay. What's in your honorable mention?
You know, man, it was hard for me to come up with any kind of honorable mention. I don't really have a whole lot of other. I have bathroom cups. That's it, like little solo cups to rinse your mouth.
What?
Yeah, it's weird.
What, do you have those at your house?
We do.
Like the ones that you have to go. It's not one that you just put in the dishwasher. Like you have one that you go buy. Like throw away bathroom cups because you can't be bothered to just put your mouth down by the sink like a normal person.
First off, my daughters use them, so you know.
Okay, well,
that.
Raise them right. Let's raise them right.
Green planet, green earth, which I agree with. But there are some instances where, you know.
Like what? What instances is this? It's too dangerous.
Listen, Captain Planet. I didn't know you were such a green planet over there.
I'm not a green planet. It has nothing to do with that. It has everything to do. You know what it is? I'm that cheap. Like, I'm going to go buy reusable bathroom cups. For what? You can put your face down there or use your hands like a normal person or just drink straight from the jug, the Listerine thing. Like, just use the cap. I'm not going out there wasting $5. How much do you spend on bathroom cups a month?
$2.99. I mean, we only buy one package a month and it gets us through a couple of months, I think.
Where do you now? Do you keep all of them on the countertop or do you keep some of them on the countertop and the rest underneath the bathroom sink?
Half and half, usually. Half on top, half underneath.
Okay, legit. If you were going to go ahead and say that you put the other half like in another room, I was going to have to say some stuff.
Well, this closet behind me actually is where the other half are, so. You know,
I could actually see you like David. Wait, now, do you only keep the bathroom cups in one bathroom or do you have bathroom cups in other bathrooms for your guests?
No, it's nothing for the guests usually. Just, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow, that's selfish. All right. What else you got?
I got nothing, man. I got nothing.
You have no other honorable mentions?
Not really, no.
Not even deodorant?
Ooh. That's a good one. Yeah, deodorant's not bad, actually. We'll add that and soap. I'll add soap to the list, too.
Yeah, soap should be in the top five. Your oversight of not having soap in the top five is as bad as my oversight of not having toilet paper in the top five. That's got to be on there. Floss also needs to be on there. Floss should at least be, even if you're not going to do it, it should at least be an honorable mention.
Yeah, or flossers, I guess.
I use flossers. I don't think anybody still uses real floss. Like, you want me to wipe...
Yeah.
Bring that shit around my fingers? Get the fuck out of here. It's 2021. Nope. I'm not doing that.
The great year of 2021. Here we go.
I mean, all right. So John and I are obviously, well, biologically we are men. I don't know if we're men in any other kind of way. But I would think that some other things you could have would be like a curling iron, a blow dryer. That's about it. That's about the only other things that I think really should rank up there.
The hair dryer, I would say, probably, yeah.
Yep. Okay. All right, dude, wash your sheets. Oh, okay, that's going to go ahead and do it for this episode of Profoundly Pointless. I want to thank you so much for joining us. If you get a chance, like, download, subscribe, share. We really appreciate it. It really helps us out. Would love to know what do you think is the most important thing in the bathroom? Nail clippers is an oversight. Because that's up there. Tweezers? That's also another good one.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device or play on PC through Facebook Games.